From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for June 25th, 2021. Game 2 of the Bucks and the Hawks playoff series is tonight at the Forum, and your first-place Milwaukee Brewers are home this weekend with the Colorado Rockies. Well, we've all heard about the various COVID vaccine promotions, a shot of booze for a shot, $1 million lottery ticket for a shot, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm not sure this promotion from the Netherlands will get people to roll up their sleeves. The country that gave us Rembrandt is offering free herring as a vaccine incentive. I think they need to throw in some crackers and a whole lot of vodka. A Nebraska man set a new world record for completing 60 skydiving jumps in 24 hours and wearing nothing but his safety harness. Look, up in the sky, it's a bird, it's a plane. Oh, wait, don't look. In recycling news, scientists have discovered a way to reuse E. coli bacteria to convert plastic bottles into vanilla flavoring. Let me repeat that. They used E. coli bacteria to turn plastic bottles into vanilla flavoring. If you're going to go through all those hoops, wouldn't you just go for chocolate? And from the animal kingdom, a new species of frog was discovered in Peru, and the biologist named it Led Zeppelin. Apparently, all the Pink Floyd fans were out of the office that day. And finally, our headline of the week comes from the Orlando Sentinel. Portable toilet inventory wiped out in Central Florida. On the podcast today, we have Brian. I've waited for that. On the podcast today, we have Brian Kill, Chris Evers, Joel Dreesing, and wrapping up the week, here's Kyle Tedding.
Well, thank you again, Max. I think we can always count on you for a good Florida headline. Overall, a great week for the markets. The NASDAQ up 2.4% this week, closing at the bell at 14,360. The S&P 500 up 2.7%, closing today at 4,281. The Dow Jones Industrial Average up 3.4% this week, adding 239 points today to close at 34,436. For the year, it's been an absolutely stellar year for the Dow, up 13.6%. Even better for the S&P 500, up 14.8%, and the NASDAQ bringing up the rear at 11.8% positive for the year. Still a pretty stellar way to look at markets almost now 6 months through. And our listeners aren't going to be able to see this, but Brian's shaking his head, I think, a bit as he
in disbelief.
As he hears me read some of those numbers. I think, you know, that's maybe a good place to start here, Brian, is just a stark reminder of just how well things have gone for investors this year.
You know, we have a tendency, Kyle, to look forward and talk about what's going to happen and how should we prepare ourselves. And but man, you got to stop every once in a while and just think, the last 18 months, from a stock market standpoint, forget about the context in which it happened, because that makes it even more extraordinary. But it's been a pretty good run, you know, and I think we ought to, as investors, take stock, no pun intended, but and just every once in a while enjoy the ride, you know, and it's been quite a ride. I was thinking, I was on a couple Fridays ago, we could have just skipped the last 2 weeks, because we basically kind of gave a bunch back last week and got it back this week, and we're about where we were, so pretty good way to start the weekend and pretty good way to end the first half of this year, I think, right?
I think so as well. And, Chris, we got some good news from the Federal Reserve this week in relation to banks. We've talked quite a bit about the role that value should be playing in portfolios right now, and in particular some of the more cyclically sensitive areas of the market, financials and bank stocks broadly being a big piece of that. The Fed coming out and essentially telling us that every major bank that applied to the stress test passed it with flying colors, which, you know, from a strength perspective, I think tells you a lot about just how well the banks came through this crisis. But beyond that, I think it also puts a little bit of a tailwind at the back of some of these banks as we look ahead, giving them greater flexibility with the cash that's on the balance sheet, giving them greater flexibility to run their businesses as they see fit.
I think that's a great point. If you look back and compare this again to 08, and you talk about what happened on bank balance sheets that time around, obviously it took a very long time before, you know, dividends and share buybacks were able to come around. But this time, as we look following the recession, banks are in great shape. And that's what the Fed reassured us again just this week as they went through that stress test and essentially said that at the end of June, the banks are going to have the green light to go back to kicking out dividends to their investors, increasing the amount of reinvestments share buybacks that they can do, which should be going forward a positive tailwind to bank stocks, which are a main component of that value side of the market that we've talked about a lot this year and the rebound that it has had versus growth. So it's just another kind of tool in the toolbox for bank CEOs that now they can going forward look to send money back to their shareholders.
Can we talk about the stumble that Chris made where he said reinvestments? I mean, you know, because that's the other thing that happens when companies have a lot of money, right? And we're not hearing as much about that. Is that something that investors should be watching or concerned about?
Yeah, you know, I think the big news we've seen so far this year is that we're talking about $500 billion in authorized share buybacks. And that's a big piece overall of what's going to happen with a lot of the cash that's out there, a big piece overall of what's going to happen with, you know, I think markets more broadly. It's one of the things that's been fairly supportive of stocks broadly. But you get to, I think, the broader point about, you know, how do people really feel about what's going on in the world? How do corporations, small businesses really feel about what's going on? I think, you know, we spent a year last year piling up cash, trying to figure out, okay, what was the right time to make choices about what to do with it? And, you know, I think as we look ahead, we're starting to see that people feel more confident making those kinds of choices than they have before.
Well, I think it also goes back to a bigger point, which is, you know, you can have more, you know, your per share price can grow. It doesn't create capital, right? I mean, what guys like us care about is the expansion of capital and how does money get put into the economy to make things that people can buy, you know, whether it's goods or services or whatever. And I think this continued idea of buybacks on top of an expansion of private money, you know, and you know, that SPACs or, you know, whatever vehicle we use to get money into companies aside from the broad markets is also very interesting because I think there's some expansion of kind of the base of capital as well. And watching those two things play out, if we have more companies being more successful, that's when I feel really good about things. You know, we've had a lot of other things that have kind of been market manipulative in the last few years that has kind of kept us our sanity. But I think putting some of that money to work that's out there flooding the system in constructive ways, that's what I'm excited about, you know? And I think we have some challenges there too, right? Because where the money came from is another discussion, you know? And a lot of it's borrowed money and has to be paid back to somebody. But if it's just switching capital from borrowed money to equity, this could get pretty exciting down the road, you know?
Yeah, and I think the other part of this conversation, Brian, is one that I know you've had for years now, but we're not just talking about more money in the system. We're talking about more money that's chasing fewer public opportunities. And so as you look at the list of publicly traded stocks, it's no wonder that if you pour money into markets, but those markets don't expand in terms of the availability of securities, you make the existing securities worth a little bit more. And so we're seeing it, you know, this whole argument of supply and demand we're seeing in so many different places now, but the equity market is certainly one of those.
You know, and let's make this maybe a little easier for the listeners to grasp and talk about the housing market, because it's the same thing, right? You got a bunch of money and, you know, people are in pretty good shape, certainly much better shape than they thought they'd be in post-COVID. But for all these various reasons, whether it's government money or whatnot, people are looking for houses, and there aren't any houses. It's not, you know, so the median house price went from, you know, up 23% or something in the last year. It's an astounding number. So the real question you would ask is, how many more houses are we going to build, and what are we going to do? Oh, but lumber is four times as expensive as it was, and these things all compete with each other, and that's what makes this fascinating, right? I do think there's got to be a great upside in building new houses if we can get there efficiently, you know, and the higher the housing prices go, the more people you ace out of the market. It's a fascinating kind of, you know, kind of dance that's going on right now in the housing market, which, again, Kyle, I think speaks in very similar terms to what's going on in the stock market as a whole.
And I appreciate those comments because it lines up nicely, Joel, with some of the economic data we saw this week on the housing front.
Yeah, we had numbers on new home sales and on existing home sales. That's kind of all the home sales, I guess. The existing home sales is the bigger chunk of the market. That's like, 12/13 or something of the market. The new home sales are a smaller piece, but these days it's a more important piece because there's a lack of homes for sale. So, the faster they can build houses, the more the supply has helped out, and those are the sorts of things that lead to the expensive houses. And one of the things that we found is that, well, first of all, the existing home sales, the annual rate of them went down for the fourth month in a row. The sales pace is still 45% higher than it was the year before, but that's that whole base effect that we talk about comparing with during COVID. And as Brian pointed out, the median price was over $350,000 for the first time ever, and that was up 24% from the year before, and that's the 111th month in a row that the year-to-year median price rose. So that's saying a lot about the supply and demand. The interesting thing about the new home sales is that if you break that down, a lot more of the new home sales are actually going toward more expensive houses and houses that aren't even built yet. So a greater proportion are you're putting money into a house that's not even where the construction hasn't even begun. So that's really sort of telling you the whole supply and demand aspect of it.
Yeah, plenty of people looking for places to live and not quite as many places to live.
I'll just jump in there and say, if you tie this to what we're seeing in the overall supply and demand in the housing market, most economists say we're about 5 million homes short of what the economy needs. And I think it's important to note that home builders are not out there to fix that issue for the economy. They would love to build more homes, but they want to protect their margins. Home builders aren't going to, nor are they able to, go out and build 5 million homes in a short period of time. So this is not really an issue that can get fixed overnight if you have a large demographic shift that's, joining the home ownership cohorts. And if there's a lack of homes, that doesn't fix itself immediately. That's not saying it's a bad thing, but it's something that you have to be aware of, that you're not going to have a flood of new homes for sale just because we're short at the moment.
That's a good point, Chris. And the National Association of Realtors actually said that they're seeing more potential home buyers just dropping out of the market because they can't afford the way prices are going. I actually have a friend who he and his wife have moved in with his mother-in-law just because they want a safe to buy a house. They can't afford one right now, so they're just going to not rent for a while or pay a little bit to his mother-in-law so that they can save more and try to wait this out.
The very worst elements of inflation right there, having to move in with your mother-in-law.
He loves with his mother-in-law.
Well, I think household formation is something that I've always, as long as I've been on this podcast, talked about how so much of an important economic driver that it is, and the inability to afford a house prevents you from household formation, prevents you from all the spending that goes along with that. And so I think that is a potential hurdle to economic growth here and something that's worth addressing, as we continue to recover. We talk about prices being a major issue. We've got some more pricing data this week with the Fed's preferred inflation measure.
That's right. That's the number that you find in the GDP, the gross domestic product report, every quarter. And there's also a monthly report that comes out that looks at personal spending. And that number is contained in both of those. So the GDP report shows the first quarter. So that's, through March. And that shows that this PCE, core PCE index went up 3.4%. Is that what I said? Yeah, 3.4% for the first quarter compared to a year before. So that's pretty high. That's above the Fed target of 2%. That's the sort of number that people who are concerned about inflation can point at and say, see, this is why we're concerned. I'm sorry. That was 1.6% for the quarter. So, which isn't very high, which is below that 2%. In fact, the long-term average for that is 3.2%. Where are my numbers here?
You've got the 62-year average at 3.2%.
Yeah, that's for the monthly one. The monthly one went up to 3.4%. That was for May. So in May, it was 3.4%, but through the first quarter, it was just 1.6%. So you can just see that little bit of time how it went from 1.6 to 3.4, and 3.4 is the highest it's been since 1992. So, you know, in that very short amount of time, we saw inflation really take off. Now, there are a lot of people who are sort of saying, this is a temporary thing. This too shall pass. And, you know, maybe, I mean, Brian, you mentioned lumber prices. We're already seeing lumber prices go down. So, you know, maybe it's those sort of one-offs that are raising things.
So that's another good point. But, you know, to be fair to lumber prices, they went from 1,400 to 1,000 in 1 week. And it was $250 2 years ago, so it's still four times, you know. But this is a fascinating conversation because, you know, throw in the kind of third element of this, right? And we use houses, again, as maybe a but you kind of say, well, all right, so I got to pay 25% more for this house, which kind of aces some people out of the market, right? The cost to build a house are greater because lumber's up or whatever we want to use. And then some of the stuff I can't even get, right? If I want to build a house right now, I can't even get a refrigerator, you know, because it's going to take. So we have these supply chain problems, which also are somewhat inflationary because to your point, Chris, earlier, which is a great point, you know, if I could build two houses and make the same money as I could build three houses, I'm going to build two of them because it's easier. You know, and I think part of the trap we may face is, you know, for a while anyway, it may be easier for people to pass these costs on and produce less, which is somewhat inflationary, which is good for margins perhaps. And we'll have to see how that settles out. And I think that's definitely what's happening in the housing market and certainly happening in automobiles right now because of the semiconductor shortage, you know, the chips shortage, you know, you're like, well, I really want to get that car, you know, so you're willing to pay a little bit more. And I think one of my concerns is it's going to take a little while longer to burn through some of these issues than people are willing to admit right now. And that'll be something to watch in the months ahead, for sure.
Yeah, Brian, I think we talk a lot about the base effect, right, that the quarter over quarter, month over month, year over year numbers all look different depending on where you started.
Absolutely.
But you rightfully point out that no matter where you started a year ago, if you look at the trend for a lot of things, we've seen prices jump pretty drastically in a number of key areas. And so while we may be talking about 40 or 50 or 60% year-over-year increases, it's still a 10 or 15% increase over the long-term trend. And lumber prices are a great example of something that if you go back 2 years, not just the last year, yeah, it doesn't look quite as drastic, but it still is a significant change.
And maybe a final point about this, and I love that the housing market is becoming kind of the focus of this conversation, but as we talk about inflation, you know, if your house costs more and interest rates go up, so the price that you're paying on your loan goes up, that's real life stuff. I mean, that's you know, a third of what most of us spend our money on anyway, and I think that does have a bearing on things. You know, some of these other discretionary items come and go, and you don't care as much, but you know, your house matters to a lot of people, so.
Yeah, you don't have to go on a trip. You don't have to get on that plane.
Exactly.
You don't have to rent a car, but you do need a place to live. You do need to go to the grocery store and buy meat and eggs.
Yep.
Assuming you eat those kinds of things. Yeah. And I think that puts you in a very different.
You offended all the vegans in our audience.
My apologies to all our vegan listeners. Certainly there are a number of proteins available for those consumers of other products. But I do think, you know, it makes the conversation about inflation much more real than what I think many of the economists are having when they talk about some of those big headline items where you go, okay, yeah, but I'm not buying a used car right now. Right. I'm not going on a trip right now.
Right.
You know, Joel, as we talk about consumer sentiment and really kind of the expectation for inflation is a big piece that's being weighed in that. We got more data today on that.
Consumer spending, you know, is two-thirds of our economy, and the consumer sentiment. The last couple of months, actually, have reported that. So today they reported that consumers actually are expecting inflation to be a short-term thing. last month they expected inflation year to year to be like 4.6%. This month already, they're saying, nah, maybe it's more like 4.2%. So they're seeing this as something that's not going to last very long. The other thing that we found out from consumer sentiment last month was the assertion that consumers have such pent-up demand that inflation the prices aren't really going to stop them from buying right now. So that's good for the economy.
You know, I think what's interesting is we talk so much about expectations. We talk so much about kind of where we've been in relation to those expectations. And, you know, as we look at some of the things that are supporting markets right now, the kinds of conversations we just had about cash moving into equities, about chasing a smaller number of equities, the reverse of that is that valuations continue to be somewhat high. You're talking about a forward PE on the S&P 500 right now of about 22.2. We talked about how well the markets have returned so far this year, and you start to get this question in your head of what should I be doing differently in my portfolio? The thing I keep coming back to as we kind of have that conversation with clients and even, you know, within the firm is the higher you go in PEs, the further along this rally goes, the lower the opportunity cost is to diversify a little bit away from what you've done in the past. That if you're talking about a market that's just gone through an incredible stressor like the pandemic or the financial crisis, you buy a broad market and just participate in the rally. But we're at a point now where, you know, things are getting more expensive or things have been more expensive for quite a while. And so you look at your portfolio and go, you know, the opportunity cost to buy something I may not have bought before, to be a little more focused in what I'm doing, isn't quite the same as it was before. And so I think, you know, there are opportunities for investors out there in areas, you know, like real assets that we might not otherwise consider. But you think, okay, if inflationary pressures are something that's a concern, rightly or wrongly, what could I buy that might participate in that? And you go, okay, infrastructure is a great example. We just reached an agreement, although we don't have a formal bill yet, on a potentially $1 trillion stimulus bill, $500 billion in new money. Sorry, in an infrastructure bill, not a stimulus bill. And we spend so much time talking about the Fed, forgetting for a second that there are real economic consequences to infrastructure spending, real economic consequences to fiscal policy. And so, Chris, Brian, I know these are conversations you have with clients, but what kinds of things are you looking at outside of just buying the index as a way to participate in, you know, the potential for an economic recovery that is going to have winners and losers?
To your point, when the market is off quite a bit and valuations are cheap, it's pretty easy just to buy broad indexes and you're going to participate in that rising tide. You know, when we're in this environment where, you know, frankly, the economic backdrop, business balance sheets, consumer balance sheets all look very good. Your main concern is just valuation is kind of the big hanging thing out over your head. There are areas in the markets, there's little nooks and crannies where you can find opportunity. I think the real assets, infrastructure is an important point. You know, as you look at this bill being passed, you can consider businesses that maybe have a high fixed cost, low marginal cost. So, you know, something that, you know, think of like a cell tower, for example. You spend all this money up front to develop and build the cell tower, but you have low cost going forward after you've done that up front. Well, in an inflationary environment, you know, you've spent the money up front in today's dollars, but you're going to grow revenue in future dollars and you have little expenses. So you have a little bit of pricing power there. So, you know, I think there's areas to find some of these opportunities in that style of infrastructure. What is beyond just the big tech companies that you frankly just been able to buy for the last 5 or 6 years in a rising tide?
You know, I guess I would make 2 points. One, the first would be, it's not just about understanding where risks are. It's understanding kind of the context of risks. And when things are, I mean, we spent this whole show talking about expensive stuff, basically, right? And we can argue about way too expensive or a little bit expensive or whatever. But if things are expensive, you know, the opportunity for things to get more expensive is less than the opportunity for things to get cheaper, right? You know, I know that sounds really stupid, but it is a meaningful point, you know, and buying things cheap over time saves you a lot of headaches and erases a lot of potential mistakes. And there aren't a lot of things to buy cheap, you know, and I think that makes me wary to do broad amounts of buying. You know, doesn't mean that we can't hang on to what we have, because certainly stocks, for instance, are a great inflation hedge, and there's probably room to run there. But I think the other point is I get this sense that, like, everybody's kind of in this post-COVID, hey, we got through this, like, amazing thing, and we have this, these vaccines, and people are back out and doing all these things and going to Bucks games. And I feel like it's just starting. Like, I feel, I look ahead right now. We were kidding about this earlier. I'll have a tendency to go through the paper every day and save it, and on Fridays rip out all the articles that I think might be fun. Like, some weeks I get like two or three things. I'd like a bajillion this week. There's so much going on and so many interesting things to watch and to be aware of in the months ahead. You know, you're talking about fiscal policy. Well, where's inflation going to go? Are these supply chains going to be short-term or long? And I think that's the key, you know, is it's not so much to predict what's going to happen. It's to be able to be, to take advantage of what happens when it happens, you know. And so if there are certain things that are expensive that you like and you find that prices come down temporarily or whatnot, be ready to do something about that, you know, because I think there will be opportunities ahead to further diversify your portfolio and do things a little bit differently to add some elements of success to your long-term plan. Yeah,
Brian, I think the funniest thing I read this week was a 2027 forecast for earnings.
Oh, God.
And we talk often about, you know, how poor we are at predicting the future, not we, those of us sitting at the table doing this podcast, but just people in general really having an idea of what even the next 12 months are going to bring. And to say, you know, that in 2027, S&P 500 earnings are going to be at $300 a share. Keep in mind, 2020 earnings, while depressed by the pandemic, were in the 130s.
Yeah.
So to go from 130 to $300 a share is an incredible rate of growth. We're going to be at maybe 190 this year, so not quite as significant of an increase. But I think if all you're doing is betting on the fact that earnings are going to grow to the moon, you miss out on some of the other opportunities that exist while things are expensive right now.
Totally.
And so I think we need to broaden our horizons when we talk about what the opportunity set is, in part because there are going to be different things that do well, but also because, Brian, to your point, I think there are different risks that we need to address now than what occurred even 6 months ago.
You know, Kyle, as the old guy in the room, I always kind of like to say, Chris, you've heard me say this a million times, but it's kind of really true. The older I get, the dumber I get, you know, and it's not that the what I know hasn't continued to grow. It has, but I so much more appreciate as I get older what I don't know, you know, and I think it's really important to kind of sit back and say, you know, yeah, I can predict this, or I can see that, or Biden's going to do this or whatever it is, but there's so many other things that have, you know, impacts on how this all comes together and everything. And to be, you know, aware of that and somewhat wary of that is, I think, makes you a much better investor and maybe a better at a whole lot of other things in the long run, too. So
I think a great note to end on, Brian. As always, thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.